Support for this podcast comes from Atlantic.net, a hosting solution provider of healthcare HIPAA, PCI compliance, and ad tech. If you are feeling the pain of having outdated technology, call Atlantic.net and get the latest security firewall, intrusion detection, backup, disaster recovery, and virtualization. Whether you're starting fresh or need a new provider, Atlantic.net can help you succeed with fully audited solutions and 23 years of experience. Visit Atlantic.net to learn more.
Everyone, this is a Sound Health Options Directions for True show with Richard Talk to Me Guy, and Sherry Edwards is still, like the Rolling Stones, out there on tour, out educating people, doing workshops, getting people to understand the potential of bioacoustics. But she will be back. She's not lost. She's just out there on tour. So that's really, I think that's actually quite good because people need to know more. Particularly what's happening in the world of healthcare. Boy, howdy, do we want to know about bioacoustics. I will make a brief announcement. We have a return engagement. Elizabeth Dost is going to be joining us to talk about, as I titled the show, Opiates in America. I really want a sound effect for that. Because it's such a misunderstanding, misguided mishigas. Wow. But before I do that, I will remind people, because there will be things said here that you're going to pass on to others, I can tell you now. And about 10 to 15 minutes after we end the show, you can go to soundhealthoptions.com, click on the radio tab, then click on the Blog Talk Radio Archive Player, and the last five shows will be there, including the show that we did on Sunday with Elizabeth, which if you didn't hear that, I recommend is an excellent precursor to this. Because on Sunday, we really talked a great deal about cannabis, which we will be talking about here as well, but really focused on that. And it's going to be a great 1-2 series. So you can find it there. You can also go to blogtalkradio.com, sign up for a free account. You don't have to sign up to find Sherry Edwards, but if you sign up for a free account, then you'll be able to follow and get notifications. And there's a lot of good listening at Blog Talk Radio. And if you sign up there and follow Sherry, that gives us points and moves us up in the rankings. You can listen to some of the over 550 shows we've done. Wow. It's amazing. Then, of course, you can go to iTunes or Pocket Cast or Dog Catcher or any, you know, kind of these days you can almost make up a name for an app and it exists in terms of podcasting. And go to either Stitcher or iTunes, those are sort of the easy, obvious ones. And search for Sherry Edwards, and you'll be able to find this show there probably early this evening, California time, maybe, you know, 2 or 3 hours. It takes them a little while to render and get them in there. And this is going to have a lot of, you know, good information. I'm going to not read as much of a bio on Elizabeth as I did on Sunday, because we really have a lot to dive into, but this is for just a little bit of a refresher of who Elizabeth Dost is. Elizabeth G. Dost is a registered nurse and senior healthcare executive with more than 20 years' experience in the Boston area healthcare market. She is currently serving as a senior executive healthcare consultant to emerging service industries, most noticeably in medical cannabis. Ms. Dost is a cannabis nurse and nominating committee member of the American Cannabis Nurse Association, clinical director of the Massachusetts Patients Advocacy Alliance, while she also consults to private entities seeking to improve lines via the medical application of and safe access to medical cannabis. Elizabeth was the vice president and executive director of a nonprofit multi-site hospice company promoting a culture of compassion to all persons and their loved ones seeking end-of-life care and support. Elizabeth joins us to clarify, air quotes, issues with opiates in America. Good evening, Elizabeth.
Good evening, Rich. How are you?
Pretty good.
Yeah. Good to be here.
Great. Really great. Really just amazing. I want to ask, actually I'm going to start slightly sideways, but we will get into it. Can you talk to us right out of the gate about the pathways of opiates in our bodies so we can understand a little more about how, you know, when they're used, how they travel the system, where they go, and what they target?
Sure. So opiates in our body are really, when we use them in response to pain, which is the correct use of an opioid, block the reception of pain at the pain center in the brain. This is why people who are paralyzed don't really experience pain. They can experience phantom pain, but they don't experience true pain because the ascending pathways, when you have an injury, go through the horn and the spinal cord and then up and is received in the brain. And so when we talk about brain about pain, I once had a rehab physician say to me that pain occurs in your brain. But there's a point of injury, and at that point of injury, that translates to up the neural pathways, up through the spinal cord, and is received as pain in your brain. So acute pain is something that happens, and the duration is stops when the injury is healed. Chronic pain is pain that goes on usually longer than 3 to 6 months. And the real danger about not mitigating chronic pain is that it can become long-term or lifelong-term pain, lifelong pain. So it's important. We also have opioid receptors, and those receptors are the ones that receive the opiates, and you have naturally occurring, you know, feel-good type substances in your body, the endorphins. People get runner's high. You think just when you're ready to collapse and die, you know, you get this rush of endorphins in response to all that exercise, the exertion. We have receptors, and those receptors are stimulated when we take opiates. And then when we withdraw from the opiates, those receptors for a while still have a sort of a, quote-unquote, craving for the opiate. And that's what we often hear of people that are addicted to opiates. It's because that withdrawal can be very uncomfortable initially and for a few days. Some people just enjoy the feeling that an opiate creates for them. So that's basically a little synopsis on pain, and just enough, I think, that we can understand that pain is a real thing. And that it's a good thing because it keeps our body safe. People that have very rare conditions where they don't experience pain are often in great peril from injury because they don't know that they've injured themselves because they're not receiving pain. So pain is really a protective mechanism. But when it's gone crazy, and it does in a number of disease conditions, pain is not a good thing, and it's certainly not a good thing to live with.
Well, no, and even if it's even if it's a low-level pain, a chronic, you know, chronic is gnarly.
Mm-hmm.
Chronic achiness. I'm not saying that we all need to be using opiates necessarily for this, but even just low-level chronic something is gnarly. You know, I had a period where I was, after my hospitalization and all that amazing adventure, I had, you know, bad pain. I had a bad wrestling match with an ostomy bag for a year and a half almost. That was never, it was never not, I am doing this intentionally, never not in pain. It was always in pain.
Yes. Yeah.
And it was a bad wrestling match. Thank you. And they really wanted me to, you know, they would give me Vicodin like crazy.
Right.
But because I didn't want to be on Vicodin because I didn't like the way it made me feel. It wasn't about getting me out of pain. It was like I didn't like the way I felt on it. It was nasty, and it didn't enhance my experience in life in a good way.
Right. And Vicodin is not generally known to be an outstanding pain reliever. I think that the show House really glamorized Vicodin Vicodin is not known to be, you know, the best pain reliever. People get spotty remission of pain with Vicodin. It's one of our combination therapy pain relievers, Vicodin, Percocet. Those, Percodan, they're combination therapy drugs, which means the opioid or the narcotic, in this case it's hydrocodone, is combined with either usually Motrin or, more popularly, Tylenol. And same thing with Percocet. Percocet is combined with Tylenol. Percodan is combined and has historically been combined with aspirin. So they're combination therapy drugs. And that's where a lot of people get into trouble with dosing, is because with Tylenol, there's not a, you know, a lot of Tylenol is not very good for you.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some things in Vicodin that could be considered somewhat worse than actually the opioid.
Right. And my experience in the healthcare, I'll get off my healthcare facility for a moment, in a moment. I think partially it was because, since in that instance, I was in a private facility, that it was a profit center for them. In other words, their doctor came in and prescribed it. They would hand it out, like, as I would joke, you know, they'd put it in a Pez dispenser, you know, almost.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you had an issue, here, take a Vicodin. And that
right.
was because I would, in the evenings, when I was up and being mobile, I'd watch the guy that would drive from Sacramento to the north part of California to deliver drugs to each of these facilities. And he'd show up every night with sheets of drugs that we'd get, you know, they were prescribed.
Right.
And the company that ran the facility was making money as that was a profit center for them. And so
did
I think
they
was
own
partially,
the pharmacy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a tricky thing. So,
mm-hmm.
And as I said, I did never enjoy or like the, you know, I know people that have taken like Vicodin recreationally, and I'm always mesmerized or confused, like, why? Look.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
That's my, you know, that. So now we are going to get to a different place, but I want to ask, what other kinds of conditions would you see that opioids are typically used?
Well, opioids are typically used in acute pain, so post-surgical, post-injury. Anything acute that's going to heal and resolve itself, but is very painful, you can think of opioids being used at. You know, you can think of people having teeth pulled, and they typically get maybe 6 Vicodin. You know, some people get more. You can think of people that have opioids are used now in chronic pain, and that's some of what we're going to be talking about, that chronic pain can often be a lifelong condition and very difficult to manage. So you see them mostly, they can be used in chronic pain, they can be used in acute pain, and that there also is a difference between using opioids to control pain and being dependent on them and being addicted to them. And that's a distinction that the average person does not make. That's actually really a teaching point in hospice when we're encouraging our patients to take their morphine, or we're talking family members through the fact that we're going to start morphine or some other opioid with their family member who is on hospice. So there are many different reasons why people take opioids. One, historically, I can just tell you very quickly, probably about 10, now, you know, time goes by, the older you get, faster, 15 years ago, there was an outcry that people that could not speak, so children, very elderly, people that couldn't speak for themselves, were being chronically undertreated for pain because they couldn't ask for pain medication. And they did some studies, and one in particular, I was at a conference, and they were talking about patients that had Alzheimer's and dementia, and that they were talking about post-total hip replacement, and that their counterparts of the same age, and these were elderly patients, who were articulate and able to make their needs known, were medicated 10 times more frequently for pain than the patients that couldn't make their needs known. But when you scan, the pain center was unscathed by the dementia or the Alzheimer's. So the conclusion was then that these patients that couldn't speak for themselves were suffering, while the patients that could ask for it were getting relief. And the same thing in children. Babies can't ask for it. Little children can't ask for it. They can say they have a boo-boo or that it hurts, but we don't really know the extent of their pain. And so there was a concern ethically that people were being under-medicated for pain. And that's when you saw that pendulum swing in that pain became the fifth vital sign. So, you know, respiration, your heart rate, you know, pain, et cetera, became something that we were assessing on an ongoing basis. And then now the pendulum is swinging back to nobody has pain. So that's where your origin started of using opioids to treat pain, or at least looking at pain as something that had to be taken seriously, affect quality of life, and certainly it was something that the medical establishment had to deal with. That's kind of the beginning of what we see now as the pendulum swinging the other way.
Right, and is that sort of in your, let's just say 20 years, I have the feeling it might be slightly longer, but let's say 20 years experience.
Yeah, let's call it 20.
Let's stick at 20. That's sort of what careened us into this, you know, I mean, we've seen specials on it, people have, you know, oh, there's just this thing that, you know, the opioids are suddenly I can't remember the cartoon character in those old, you know, like in the black trench coat with the big mustache and the bad guy, you know, the opiates have become like the evil ne'er-do-well drug. Is that sort of, do you think that's part of the factor that we went from not enough and swung through like, okay, we've got a good place.
Almost too much.
Over too much. It's just like,
yeah,
here, take this.
Yeah. And I think there's been a couple of things, and I'll be honest with you. I've seen a hyper-regulation of physicians. Over my lifetime and over my career, I have seen a hyper-regulation of physicians by people that are not physicians. So by anyone that has a financial interest in sort of controlling physician-related orders or care plans or actions, we've seen a hyper-regulation of physicians. And then I think that we've seen so that maybe opioids are being second-guessed by people that are paying for it. So we see payers that are hyper-regulating physicians. So we've devalued their knowledge. And I think that we have seen an uptick in the use of heroin in and among our suburbs. And it's a tragedy. And I do want to say that I have had friends and I have lost people that I care about to drug addiction and overdose. And it's a terrible thing. It's a terrible, terrible thing. I've also worked on the floor where we had many alcoholics who came in for end-stage alcoholism, which is a terrible, terrible affliction.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you, I've never met an alcoholic that I didn't like when they were sober. They were the nicest, kindest people. And I think sometimes that alcohol helped them cope with life's difficulties. And that's kind of a generalization, but I will tell you that I had great sympathy and great empathy for those alcoholic patients that we saw. And I think that now because the fentanyl is being added to the heroin and everything is, this is causing more opioid-related deaths, what we've done is we've totally vilified opioids, the substances themselves, rather than what's going on in society that is causing this uptick in the use of these drugs. And that is called addiction. When someone is dependent on a medication, they're dependent for their wellness. So someone that has insulin, that has diabetes, is dependent on insulin to live. Somebody that has hypertension is dependent on their antihypertensives to live. Somebody that has chronic, unrelenting pain is dependent on whatever that mechanism is that allows them to live a robust, full life. And if it's an opiate, so be it. And we discussed, I think, opiates and cannabis as having a synergistic effect. But what I've started to see and what people are reporting is that patients that take opioids and then try to integrate cannabis in their overall health plan and trying to lower the amount of opioids they take or maybe work synergistically with the opioids that they're taking, once they test positive for THC, they're getting their opioids yanked. And this is what I've heard. And I've heard from pharmacists that they have had patients that were on opioids for many years. They never early fill. They're very compliant. They have one physician. And now that physician is afraid to write the script anymore because they're being hyper-regulated by the government and their health and whoever is their payer source. And so patients are being left in chronic pain. And these are patients that had been managing, So there's a lot of different social and economic forces at play here.
Yeah, I was at a conference, and I was at a panel, a veterans panel, and because I'm of that vintage, I did not serve in the military, but I was protesting, a real hardcore protester. I'm pro-soldier, anti-war.
Mm-hmm.
And I was listening to soldiers who are coming up to an open microphone, and particularly, I don't know why, maybe it's because I relate to that vintage and I went to college with a lot of guys that were in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
but I relate to them in particular. And there were guys coming up to the microphone who were just cursing a blue streak about how pissed off they were about they had been managing their discomfort,
yes.
either injury-related or psychological trauma-related or whatever it was, quite well with cannabis for decades.
Yeah.
However, then they wanted Vicodin or some opioid because they were having more
mm-hmm.
physical pain, and
mm-hmm.
that they would be fine, but then their VA doc would then threaten them, if you test positive for THC, I'm taking away your Vicodin.
And how
and
does that even make
were,
sense?
And these guys were nuts about that. I mean,
of
in a positive, articulate way. You know, but just like, wait a minute, I have been managing my condition for decades with this balance. Why would you blank me now? I mean, what?
Exactly.
It's madness. It's
exactly.
just madness.
Exactly. It is madness. And I think part of the madness comes from the fact that the people that are over, for the most part, the people that are using drugs illegally are doing that. They're using drugs illegally. And they are affecting health care for compliant, well-cared for patients that are seeing their physicians, and their physicians are feeling jammed because they're stuck between a rock and a hard place, and public opinion is against them in writing these prescriptions when, and little did you know, but not only does your health insurance become part of your or your health care plan, but your pharmacists suddenly become part of your health care plan. And the government is now becoming part of your health care plan, when it used to just be a private thing between you and your physician. And I'm not talking about HIPAA, but, you know, they have had great access to your information and these distribution centers, which, and listen, pharmacists are very well-trained chemists. They're very well-trained. And I urge people to use your pharmacists, ask them questions, pick their brains. If you have a new medication or you have adverse reactions to your medications, I always tell people, go to the pharmacist at any one of the, even the large chains, go to the pharmacist. They're very bright. They're very intelligent. They go to school a lot. But they are really not part of that physiological health care plan that you have embarked on with your physician. They are there to fill the order that the physician has discussed with you. I had a physician tell me, She happened to be working in an emergency room, and somebody came in with a complex urinary tract infection. And a complex urinary tract infection means just that. It's just more than a bladder infection. It can start migrating up to the kidneys. It can be very serious. Mm. And she ordered something that was not a, wasn't an opiate. It was a seldom used for urinary tract infection antibiotic. And the pharmacist called and questioned her extensively on why. And she finally said, did you see the patient? She has a complex urinary tract infection. I'm an ER doc. This is the drug she needs. When did you get your MD? So I guess I'm a very big supporter of physicians. And I think that we have devalued our physicians. And we need our physicians. We need general practitioners. We need people that see the whole picture. And it's just, who wants to do that anymore? With the expense of going through medical school, pre-med, and then the exposure, and now you're under scrutiny by the government and by your health, by the healthcare insurer of the patient for everything, and you're answering to people that aren't physicians. It's a hard road. It's a tough life. You know, we have to, there used to be a status to it. And I don't know so much anymore that there's a status to it. So I really want to thank all the physicians, any of your listeners who are doctors. I think it takes a lot. It certainly takes a lot of education, a lot of stamina. It certainly is a marathon, and it's a constantly changing environment. And they're fairly, very courageous in their care for patients.
Well, and I think, I don't remember if we talked about this on the show on Sunday, but I think we talked backstage about my experience with, I had three surgeries, two different doctors, but three surgeries. And I have nothing but respect for those surgeons, and the systems they work in were amazing. I mean, they did things that were like, wow, and very skillfully,
right,
and in great organizations. I mean, just, you know, one of my operations, it was at a UC Med Center in San Francisco, which is just a massive organization, but the word is organization. It is organized. It is like clockwork in a very positive way with great care and great caring. I cannot say that same. I don't have that same feeling about the healthcare facility I was in, which felt more, much more like a machine to make money off of people who were sick.
Because
it is a business. That is really a hard, serious business, and that's a very tricky area. But I have nothing but respect for my doctors who did the surgeries, because, as you say, it is really hard, high-pressure work. And, again, it is an organization. It is a business. So there's a lot of pressure to be efficient. But at some point, particularly in surgeons, it's like, listen to the surgeon. They're the one. They've got the knife in their hand. I think we need to listen to that
person. And please don't complain to me that your surgeon is arrogant and not personable, because thank God. Because they need to be arrogant. You want somebody pretty confident if they're going to crack your chest and work on your heart.
I want Mario Andretti at the wheel. I want somebody who's cocky and full of himself and totally like,
I know what I'm doing. Absolutely. You want those people that say, I have arrived, let surgery begin. That's what you want. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because
I'm not looking for somebody
abdomen.
That's hesitant, like, I don't know, what do you think? No.
That's right.
That's bad.
That's right. And I feel that physicians that are starting to be pain physicians are starting to have that same stamina and that same, constitution to really correctly prescribe opioids, because it's a hostile environment that we live in. We've gone too far the other way.
I had a doctor associate, a friend, but also I worked on his setting up his office system. And he was an osteopathic surgeon. He then went back to school and got a degree as an anesthesiologist, because he wanted to know about that.
Wow.
And then he
got
a degree as a chiropractor. So this guy had most of his life in education. And he ran a pain management clinic in Northern California that was very successful for his patients.
Yep.
However, some insurance company decided, oh, we need you to give us back that $500,000 that we gave you because we've changed our plan. You know, something bad, something just completely bogus. And this guy was constantly, I was around him enough to watch that he was always fighting for his patient. He was always trying to manage pain, and pain is really hard to manage. And like you said, with this endless bureaucracy of people who are not doctors telling you you can't do that blows my mind.
Right. And cannabis is not the great white horse that's going to come in and save everyone from the need for stronger pain medication. It's just not. Because in order for cannabis, in most instances, to work on pain, really acute pain, we're talking higher doses of THC. It's a very effective pain reliever, but it's going to make you high. And there are just some people that don't like to be high. They don't like to function high. They might not mind it before they go to bed and go to sleep, and I think we had this conversation. But the notion that everybody that wants to take cannabis is looking for that THC high is just wrong. In fact, studies have shown that most medical marijuana patients are actually looking for lower THC blended cannabis plants than higher THC blended cannabis plants because they want that action of a total body lift, which is kind of what cannabis gives you, an overall improvement. If we remember really briefly, it interacts with the endocannabinoid system, which is the largest modulator in your body, which seeks to create homeostasis or a balance in your body. If you take cannabis, it's going to boost that system. That boost generally gives people a feeling of well-being. It can also abruptly, you know, cause cessation of a symptom, but not always. So some people look at cannabis as an ongoing therapeutic tool in their box of pain medication mitigators, if you want to call it. So, you know, they have one tool, cannabis. They might have another tool, which might be long-acting morphine. They might have another tool, which might be sometimes anti-seizure medications work very well for chronic pain. But we're starting to talk now about chronic pain and patients that are looking to mitigate chronic pain so that they can have a quality of life. And I think that most people do not suffer from chronic pain. People suffer from acute pain, and the other thing about pain is that it's subjective. So I can't really describe when I'm in pain exactly what it means to me, to you. So you just have to take for my word of it, about it, what it means to me. And that is, that's why being a pain doctor is so difficult, because each person's pain experience, their tolerance to pain, et cetera, all those things that factor into pain management are different from patient to patient to patient. And the way they react to drugs are different from patient to patient to patient. So people are looking to help for cannabis to help give them that boost. Or if it can, you know, you hear these wonderful stories, and they're always wonderful if somebody can come off their opioid pain medications by using cannabis, but they're probably using a lot of cannabis, and that's also very expensive. And it also doesn't work for everyone. It also doesn't work for everyone.
Yeah.
So we cannot make assumptions and generalizations that because it works for some, that it works for all.
Right. And I, from the herbal side, I will say that as cannabis, I do live in Northern California, so I'm in one of the, cannabis meccas or whatever California is that as I see more people producing products where they're actually very specifically testing so they know exactly what's in each drop, or when they put it into, I have an associate who makes a line of baked goods, and he's doing a lot of work with people who are ill or have long-term conditions. And he is very specific about what dosage is in a brownie bite. And his, we've had long conversations about this, that that's really his striving point. He says, I have people I'm dealing with that have cancer or, you know, that have a condition where they need to know that when the same, the brownie bite that they had last Tuesday will be the same brownie bite they have today, so that they know how to adjust their own medication. And that's really a powerful thing. And I that's one of the things I like about cannabis in being added to pain management or pain protocols, is that it does give them a little bit more availability. I think we've talked about vaping, where somebody can take a couple of hits off a vape pen, and if that's not enough, 20 minutes later, they can do that again. And that just gives the patient so much power to really be more able, as they are, to help guide their own, you know, like, I'm, wait, that's too much, I can't do that again, but, you know, I need another hit because this is welling up. Or and really, chronic pain is just, it's gnarly. It can be, you know, it can be, so, as you well know, I mean, it can be just so, I'm trying not to use the word devastating, but I can't think of another word. I mean,
it's,
it really
devastating.
Can be.
If you read about chronic pain conditions such as fibromyalgia, spinal stenosis, myofascial pain syndromes, anything that's chronic where people might have had a broken bone or a hip replacement that was just not set, it just didn't set exactly right, and now they have chronic hip pain. Chronic hip pain will throw their back off, then they have chronic back pain. Back pain is devastating, you know, when people have spinal stenosis or bulging discs or fusions. It can be just absolutely devastating to people. And all these chronic pain conditions, if you read about them, are described as devastating. And I think I read a study once that said about a third of patients that suffer from fibromyalgia have entertained suicide thoughts, because the quality of life changes when you're in chronic pain. And there are a lot of, and pain is invisible. Unless you have a gaping wound or a compound fracture, or you have a bloody bandage, you know, people can't really, if you're walking around and you look pulled together and you have chronic pain, people have a hard time believing that.
Yeah.
But what's your alternative? What's the alternative? I mean, I think that what I see as a nurse and what I see in the general population is that it's kind of amazing what people can get used to. Or, let me put it this way, adapt to. But they may need help adapting to that. And let's not cut opioids out of the equation, because opioids are effective pain relievers. Do they have side effects? Yeah, they do. Do they have, can they at very high doses kill you? Yes, they can. How do they do that? Typically, they depress the brain center, the brain stem, and that's where all those automatic functions occur, including breathing. So they just decrease, they just tamper the respiratory drive. And that's really what happens. And what I'm hearing, I've heard two interesting things, if you can call them interesting, kind of astounding things about people that return to illegal drug use. And by illegal drug use, I'm talking about people that inject heroin, take drugs that are not, they're not in pain, and they take the drugs for the high. You know, Oxycontin was, which is long-acting Percocet, and oxycodone is Percocet. You know, people would take them and chew them so that they got the full effect as a big rush. And that was the big downfall of that drug, which was an excellent long-term pain reliever. You take one in the morning and you might have pain relief for 12 hours. It's wonderful when it's used correctly. We're talking about all these things being used illegally. And what happens is that you've had somebody that's been clean and sober, say, for 5 years. They went through a treatment program. There's really no reason now for them to take it, and then they reinject themselves with, they decide to start using heroin again, and or the drug, their drug of choice again. And sometimes what they do is they go back to the last dosage that they had, and at that time they had built up a tolerance, and this time it knocks out their respiratory center. They also, there also is some speculation that because so many people are carrying Narcan on them, which we used to, when we had chronic, when we would have acute patients, that were not intubated and we were concerned about their breathing, we would tape it, you know, to the wall just in case, you know, patient had an adverse reaction to a drug. And now that firemen and people carry that around, I've heard that there is a societal change in that people know that they can actually be, they can get higher, take more risk because there's this drug that reverses the action. And then I also heard, the other thing I've heard from someone that was involved in drug culture, she was a reformed person that had used illegal drugs, is that on occasion people that are peddling illegal drugs will use a stronger drug, and that then it gets out that their drugs are very good, and so it's good for business to occasionally have somebody that needs to be needs some intervention, because it speaks to the quality, I suppose, of their drugs. And these are all conversations that I've had with former addicts and people that have had drugs, drug problems, and now use cannabis, and use cannabis for medical purposes.
Yes. Now I want us to migrate to cannabis. Actually, I want us to migrate to hospice. But first, I have to ask a question. It almost seems like I'm laughing as I think about this. It almost seems like opioids need an ad campaign to be clarified that they're not the bad guy. They're not. I mean, we've talked backstage. I mean, morphine and opiates have been around for a long time.
Forever. You know, morphine's the gold standard. It's been around. It's a wonderful drug when used appropriately. Can you imagine you've just had huge abdominal surgery and you're writhing in pain and you can't have anything? Well, they come in, they give you your morphine. It's the gold standard. It's the one that every other opioid is kind of put up against. It's been around. It's like the grandfather of them all. And it's a very effective pain reliever, and not in really high doses, but you can go up and up and up. A lot of it depends, too, on how the body metabolizes. You know, in pain, what really happens in pain, when a patient is in pain, chronic pain, they have a hypersensitivity to painful stimuli. So something that wouldn't bother a person that's not in pain can be overwhelming to a person that's sensitized to pain, because the brain undergoes changes with chronic pain. It gets more. It becomes a smart organ because it trains itself to receive the pain. And what happens in chronic pain is that the body lays down more neurons to receive the pain. So that's why if you have acute pain that goes on for 3 months, that then goes on for 6 months, that you have not blocked that reception of pain in the brain, the body starts laying down more neurons, like just like adding another lane to the highway so that the brain receives the pain signals. I thought that was fascinating when I first heard a physician, and I would certainly give him the credit, but it was a while ago when I went to this pain conference, and I was astounded that that was actually the pathophysiology of chronic pain, is that the body gets very smart about being able to receive it because it's being bombarded by these signals. So it's harder to get chronic pain under control, and patients may need more opioids than anyone would think is appropriate, and then you start having people coming in and looking at examining your health plan, as they call it, especially insurance companies, and they start partnering with you to help you. When as you said, your vet guys are getting all mad, and rightfully so, that they've been managed, and now all of a sudden someone's screwing with their lives and their wellness.
Yeah, it is amazing. I want to talk, you said something on Sunday about hospice, and I want you to talk about hospice again, because I really want people to understand, as you said, you know, hospice is like the good side is that it's a magic sweet spot. I mean, it is a sad place because it's a place that people to go to die, but it's a very, talk about hospice care.
So hospice care, and I described it as being the jewel of the Medicare, the plethora of Medicare benefits that we enjoy in the United States. And I think that it is probably the best done or best executed of the Medicare plans available to people. And basically that just means that if you've paid into your quarters and you get Medicare and you're over 65 or 62 and you've elected your and you're on Medicare, that you are automatically eligible for hospice care if you are terminally ill. Because Medicare does it, Medicaid does it for patients under 65, and because Medicare and Medicaid do it, all the insurances have some sort of a hospice benefit. But the hospice benefit under Medicare is a beautiful benefit. It incorporates not only nursing, physicians, social work, all the allied therapies can be utilized under the hospice benefit, the OT, PT, speech, et cetera, swallow therapy, dietitians. But it also incorporates spiritual care, and it incorporates volunteerism, and it's mandated. You have to have these services in a hospice organization. But what we were talking about that's very germane, I think, to our conversation that we're having tonight is that it's an election. People elect this benefit. And when they elect this benefit, it is a powerful statement to their caregivers if they elect it for themselves or if their healthcare proxy elects it for them. And what they're basically saying is that they are accepting the fact that they are in a terminal status and that their life is limited and their lifetime, their life expectancy is limited, and that what they're asking for is palliation of suffering and attention to, they want to be free from suffering. That's base, and they don't want anything extraordinary, invasive. I have hospice patients that no longer receive finger sticks for blood sugars. They just go with a standard insulin injection. They have no more blood draws. They don't want any more needles. They don't want any more hospitalizations. They just want to sort of let nature take its course. They want to enjoy the time that they have left, and they want to be comfortable. And comfortable generally means the patient-driven care plan, which means it's the patient's wishes. Just at a time when you think that you do not have any control, all the control is handed back to you under this Medicare benefit. And you make a powerful statement about how you want to live the rest of your life. And most patients want to live either at home, whatever they call home, and they want to live as comfortably as possible. And that could involve many modalities that that creates that comfort that they are asking for. So they've already given the hospice team the permission to create a comfortable environment for them. And that does often mean using comfort meds, which include Vicodin, morphine, Percodan, Percocet, Dilaudid, fentanyl. You know, it's given in micrograms in a patch, which is over time because it's 100 times more powerful than morphine. But as a patch, it's just slowly released over a couple of days. And so there are many things. And we use a lot of adjunctive meds, too, all sorts of different medications, from anywhere from steroids to anti-seizure medications to anti-inflammatories, all sorts of different kinds of medications that we feel. And hospice also will also DC or discontinue medications that are no longer relevant. You know, you don't really need to be controlling your high cholesterol if you're in the last stages of your life. So get rid of that drug. And you'll be amazed when patients come off their cocktail of drugs and their pain is controlled. They often get a bump and they improve for a while. And we see that fairly consistently. So that's pretty much hospice in a nutshell. Yeah.
And in that mix, is now cannabis being considered as an adjunctive possibility?
Yes. In fact, one of the things that, cannabis unfortunately remains in Schedule 1 at the federal level, which means it has no benefit, no medical benefit. And we just absolutely know that that's not true, but it remains in Schedule 1. CBD is remaining in Schedule 1. That has no psychoactive effects. And so it's getting hard. It's hard for practitioners. I have the pleasure and the privilege of speaking to the Massachusetts Federation of Hospice and Palliative Care this fall. It will be my second year in a row. And there's just many nurses that are very, very pro-cannabis use, but there's not a lot of literature. Like you said, your buddy that makes the brownie bites, that mm-hmm. it's exactly the same brownie bite. We have people that are doing that are really like they're chefs, or, you know, they've taken the extraction done by a dispensary. Mm-hmm. But a dispensary isn't a healthcare pharmaceutical company in the way we think of it as being. It's an herbal. It's an herbal supplement. Really, it's an herb, and you know more about that certainly than I do. And so the problem with it's not the problem, but the way nurses and physicians work is they work basically on dose-related. It's dose-related administration. And so it's hard because cannabis is something that a lot of people play with for a while before they get that, now I know what I need to take.
Right.
You know, so I always tell people when you're introducing a higher dose or whatever, don't plan on doing anything.
Yeah.
Tonight. You know, do it at night and put on a movie, and make sure you have popcorn or something because you're going to want Chinese food in about an hour or a burrito.
Yeah.
But you know, if you're trying to really experiment with cannabis and how it makes you feel to get to that place, don't plan on doing it. Don't do it in the morning. Do it at night, you know, as you're watching TV. And give yourself a couple of hours so that you know how you're feeling, especially if you're starting out on edibles. Yeah, yeah.
You'll well, edibles, yeah.
But
edibles
you don't want
to lay on
sleep for 16 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, edibles is a trick. Even people I know that are experienced consumers, I know some of them that do consume regularly. And every once in a while, one of them will, like, throw up their hands like, nope, I can't eat anything. I can't eat them. Because it's too long term, but in the hospice realm, that seems like a I can't commit. I can't do anything.
I can't commit to 16 hours of sleeping.
No,
and rest.
No,
exactly.
But in the hospice, setting,
wonderful.
So because of the fact that it is an herbal supplement, does that give it any wiggle room in? Could, let's say I had a mother in hospice, could I bring my mother in hospice brownies because it is just an herbal adjunct?
Well, people have been bringing people hospice brownies forever. And you know, in the legal states, you know, what we're trying to do in my state is just fast track so that hospice patients, we would like to see cannabis be moved up as opposed to a last resort. We'd like to see it be bumped up to more of a first try. Let's try some cannabis first.
Yeah.
See how you do with that. You know, wouldn't that be wonderful that you could take something that has no deaths related, there's no ceiling on it.
Right.
There's hardly any receptors in the brainstem, so you're not going to fall asleep and stop breathing.
Right.
You're just going to sleep. You can get paranoid. I'm not going to say that there are not uncomfortable effects of cannabis because that would be untrue. That's some people. But what happens is people learn, okay, with that, I always encourage people to journal. I didn't get a good effect from, you know, sour diesel, 20 milligram, you know, cookie.
Yeah.
Journal that because the next time sour diesel is on sale, you may want to remember, oh, I didn't get a good effect from that sour diesel, or maybe it was the dosing was too high.
See, and I would,
but wouldn't it be
and
nice
particularly
to
because,
try that first?
And particularly because I live in, again, the state, and also I've interviewed some of the manufacturers, people who, there's a company called Care by Design, who makes a really wonderful line of, again, they show you right on the bottle drops, liquid drops based in coconut oil. So it's a CO2 extract that's then diluted into drops so that when you take a drop, you know exactly what's in there. And that's the way I suggest for a lot of people to start orally because you know really precisely you've had one drop, you've had five drops. They make it in various potencies. They make a higher CBD one. They make a 4-to-1. They make a 16-to-1. They make all sorts of ratios. And I think that's a great delivery system for people to try. You know, like, okay, that 4-to-1, 5 drops of that 4-to-1 was not much. Let's try the 1-to-1. And, but I mean, it gives you a little bit of control versus.
It does.
You know, smoking
and
is trickier.
And if they put those drops under their tongue, they might even get a faster response and they'll know how they're feeling quicker.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's, we call it sublingual, and, you know, it's very vascular under their tongue. And, you know, they might find that they get a better. Morphine is often given under the tongue in hospice.
Mm-hmm. And how are you? I can't believe it. We're, you know, got like 6 minutes.
I know.
How, in your state, is there a way, do we think that, well, this is really a federal issue, but do you think there's anything we can do to get these, everybody fill in the expletives of their choice, whatever's, to take at least CBD out of Schedule 1?
I can't even believe they put it back into Schedule 1, CBD only.
Yeah, I mean, it's CBD. Cannabidiols are like the most benign nothingness. I mean, they're very beneficial. I think, of CBDs as a long-term beneficial effect. I take them for anti-inflammatory purposes.
Yes, of course.
And, you know, nothing but good benefit. But, I mean...
Yes, great. It's great. I think that, you know, first of all, it shouldn't be scheduled at all because it's an herb. You know, when we schedule our drugs, we schedule them. They're pharmaceuticals. They're made by pharmacies. You know, by pharmaceutical companies. Cannabis is grown out of the ground, put there by our creator, I would say.
Yep.
And it's been, you know, used for 4,000 years. There's been nothing that's had more human trials out there than cannabis. And, you know, we're trying to, it shouldn't even be scheduled because schedule is an inappropriate placement. I think physicians might like it because they're going to try and put milligrams on it, but what they're going to try and do is they're going to try and pharmaceuticalize something that is perfect in nature. And, you know, I'm not for that. And so I'd like to see it completely descheduled, and as would many cannabis activists. And it's just going to be a matter of time. But, you know, I heard something really interesting, and I know we're pressed for time, but kind of wanted to have your listeners hear. It was on one of the morning shows, one of the top three morning shows, and they were talking about cannabis and the drug war and how it's affected drug use in the United States. And I thought, oh, here we go again with this entry drug, which is not true for cannabis. Here we go again with this. I'm going to have to listen to it, but I stayed to listen to it. And what was very interesting was they were saying that his point was not that it was an entrance drug to harder drug. His point was that now coming into the country are harder drugs because the demand for cannabis from down south outside our country has decreased because of legalization. So they're replacing it with other drugs.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
was his point, which was, I thought, very interesting. And that was how it was contributing to drug use, not that it was launching people in a life of drug use, but that it was being taken kind of out of the market of illegal drugs because it was being legalized so much. I think the biggest thing about cannabis, and if your listeners want to make, it's important to make sure your legislators understand that you are pro-cannabis use. Especially, please, let's start at the very least, even with hemp, but medical marijuana. And I think your legislatures need to know that you are for it. And I think that they need to understand, too, that the vilification of marijuana came because alcohol sales did not rebound after prohibition ended. And I think that there was the perception by very powerful individuals that had a lot of power and could make legislative changes that cannabis was the competitor for liquor now. And if you get rid of cannabis, then the liquor sales would rebound. So when you think that that is the origin of why something is not being used, it kind of takes the argument away from the legitimacy. It's not a legitimate reason. It was an economic reason.
There was marketing involved.
It was marketing involved.
So
that's
speak.
Right.
There kind of like I have to toss out the when you were talking about the pharmaceutical industry, you know, back to cannabis, when they produced Marinol, that was an example of what happens when you try and just take a pretty perfect, I'm not saying cannabis is perfect, but I mean, herbs are whole foods unto themselves. Each herb has all major constituents in there, and it's a balanced food unto itself, each herb. And what they tried to do is they tried to, okay, here's what we need to make synthetically out of that because we can make boatloads of money selling this, and it didn't work. It didn't give cancer patients relief. It didn't give anybody relief. It just, anybody I know that tried it was just like in a bad mood.
They
didn't like it.
It's not popular. You know, we use it to stimulate appetite, but we would do much better if somebody would just smoke a joint a day. Their appetite, they'd be raging. And I mentioned on Sunday how we had a patient that gained 9 pounds in a month because he was using cannabis. He was inhaling it, smoking it. And he did very well with that. But the Marinol,
he was possibly
randomly
laughing can occur.
Yes, occasionally happy or feeling pleasant. I mean, certainly if you're in the terminal phases of your life, don't you want the freedom to use anything that you want to mitigate any type of suffering or anxiety that you're... And that's where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
I really care about patients and I really care about people. And I think that we can do better as a people taking care of people. That's kind of how I feel. And we just aren't there yet. It's unfortunate.
Yeah. I'm trying to come up with a happy note. I can't after that. Yeah. Well, I'm thinking about what they're, you know, the vote that occurred today and what they're trying to do. It's just the direction. I don't know. I think we just have to keep moving forward and grow cannabis and consume it legally or not when necessary. And and really, as you say, for people who are suffering, I don't understand that restrictive agenda, whatever the foundation is, whether it's monetary or religious or just opposed because they're opposed. But I mean, if people are suffering, as you say, when they're in a hospice setting, I think they should have the right to do whatever it takes to be comfortable.
Exactly.
I mean, within reason.
Within reason. And I also think that, you know, one of the things that you don't see is that people that chronically suffer are not the people that come out and advocate for themselves because they can't, because they don't feel well enough to do it.
Right.
And that's when they need people like us to get on air and say that this is a valid and an important issue that faces us as a society, because how we care for the most marginalized, the most fragile, the most vulnerable. If you go back and remember what I said about why pain medication was used more frequently, was because they found that the people that couldn't ask for pain medication were not getting pain medication, but it did not mean they were not in pain. It just meant that they could not ask for it. And how we take care of each other as a society is something that we have to live with as a society. And you know when you really care about it? When it happens to you. Or when it happens
suddenly,
to someone you love.
Yeah, suddly you care.
Suddenly it becomes an enormous issue when it happens to you. But
that's
when it's
really
happening
amazing
to somebody else, and I don't mean, I don't mean to dispel or devalue any of the heartache that people have gone through with drug abuse and overdosing and losing loved ones. But at what price do we put people that suffer? Where do if you cannot have access to pain relief and you have no access to cannabis, what happens to you? You fall into this ever-growing hole of people just ignoring your needs, and you become non-productive. And people being non-productive and in pain and suffering, and they cannot get relief. It's inexcusable. It's just inexcusable. And in this day and age, when we have so many intelligent, and we have so many avenues to relieve pain and suffering, and those people are the marginalized with no voice anymore. And so that's why I appear on radio shows like yours, to try and give a voice to the people that don't have him.
Yeah. Thank you for what you do.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you.
You bet. All right. I hate to say this, but we're out. That's it.
Our hours will go very fast.
Our hours will go very fast. We may have to do this again because there's more.
We may have
more.
To do it again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thank you
about.
So much again. That was excellent. I knew that was going to be
my pleasure.
Fun-filled. You know, it's an amazing.
Yes.
Amazing
Don't anyone
world.
Hesitate to ask for pain medication because you're embarrassed. That's the bottom line. Take care
That's
of yourself.
Great, yeah, take care of yourself.
Yep.
All right, everybody. Thank you very much. And we'll see you guys on Sunday. Have a great rest of the week. Bye-bye.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye.